This is an interview with Elizabeth Hill Johnson, June 25th, 1986, Tape 1, Side 2.
My father, though, and through his side of the family, had later came into some income that augmented his railroad income, and that let us do a lot of things that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. He had, his father had a sister who had married a very wealthy banker, and another sister who had married a wealthier man, and they owned, owned stock in Standard Oil and some of the, because Northern Ohio developed a lot of oil, mm-hmm. and also in some manufacturing companies and whatnot. And so when the one sister who had only one child and who lived in Bellevue, and my mother and father looked after her husband died a lot, when she died and her doctor son had preceded her in death, my father was the chief heir of her estate, and that gave my mother an interest in stocks and the stock market and financial things, and she then began to study that. She never was a great trader, but she was very conversant with the stock market and what was going on, Wall Street and so forth, and began reading the Wall Street Journal.
At what point in your life was that?
Oh, this was when I was in grade school, I guess, during the 20s, it must have been that Andy Mall died. And so I think we rode the stock market up, but were not caught in any kind of a problem when the thing crashed. But that helped me go to college.
Yeah, I see.
So we had a little nest egg for me to go to college. Uh-huh. But when I went to college, I went to the school that gave me the best scholarship at the moment. And I didn't, in those days, students didn't apply as much. And it just was assumed I was going to go to college. So then when I graduated from high school, and I think this one fellow and I were tied for top spot in our high school, had almost a straight A average, I just started. And in those days, and in that little town, we had some of the finest teachers in the world, and we all took 4 years of English, and I took 4 years of Latin. Some of the kids took 2 years of Latin and 2 years of French or Spanish, and we had 3 solid years of mathematics. We had 3 solid years of science. We had debate, band, orchestra, drama. I was a swimming instructor. We had a swimming pool in our high school, and I can't think of anything really that we didn't do. But I was offered a scholarship to Oberlin College, and that's where I thought I was going to go. That was only about 50 miles from home, but I would have lived on campus anyway. And we were only about 60 miles from Cleveland, and we did our shopping in some of it in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. We had railroad passes, we could go between those places for free. And then I got a better scholarship at Ohio Wesleyan, where my favorite English teacher had graduated. And then I later got a full scholarship to Miami University at Oxford, Ohio. All of this influenced by my teachers. My history teacher was a Delta Gamma and a very strong woman and a wonderful teacher, and she was inclined toward Miami University. My English teacher was the Ohio Wesleyan one. My Latin teacher was Ohio State, but I didn't want to go to a school that big, and many of the fellows from our class were going to Ohio State. And one fellow went to Yale, and one went to Ohio University. One went to Western Reserve. His father was a railroad man, and that fellow had passes, of course. He commuted every day to Western Reserve University, had a tuition scholarship, worked during the day. His father didn't give him any money to go to college at all, so he had to earn the whole thing. He was so talented, he graduated with 2 baccalaureate degrees later studied law. He was also a drama and music student at the same time. I don't really know how Don kept body and soul together. He later was the legal top lawyer for U.S. Steel and died at a quite early age.
What was his last name?
Horton.
Don Horton.
Uh-huh. And then Howard Kuhn, one of my very good friends who was named after the local doctor, wanted to be a doctor. He knew that from the time he was a little kid. He graduated with then the highest grades from Ohio State Medical School, and they wanted him to be a specialist, but he wanted to come back to that little town and practice general practitioner. He and I were very close friends, not dating or anything like that, but very often I used to go with him and sit outside houses in Lorain and Elyria where he'd be looking after sick babies. And I used to tell him he was working too hard. He practiced all alone. I think he delivered every baby in the town. And he used to say, "Don't worry about me. I'll probably pop off with a coronary when I'm 45 anyway." And his father had died very suddenly, and his father and he were terribly close. And I was shocked when I picked up the newspaper and saw he had died of a coronary at 54.
Mm.
And another one of my friends, whose father was the principal of the high school, also studied medicine. The Baptist minister's son became a college professor of physics. Our high school principal taught us physics. Our high school Latin teacher had a mentally disabled sister, and she was not married, and it was easier for her to keep her sister in a smaller town than in a college town where she had been. She was our Latin teacher. She had a master's degree in Latin. Our English literature teacher, graduated from Wellesley College, was an extremely talented person. Our drama teacher had come from a college teaching to that little town. I don't know how they were lucky enough, because they didn't pay decent salaries. You know, in those days, teachers got very little, even in the big scheme of things. By comparison, teachers used to get a $50 increment a year. And I guess I always knew that I was going to be a teacher, because my fifth and sixth grade teacher, Miss Warner, let me take over the class. She was the principal also. And so when the phone would ring outside the door and Miss Warner would have to go to the phone, I immediately stepped up and took the class over. And so the superintendent of schools in those days stood outside the door several times and watched me whip those kids into order in there. And he said to my mother and father, "Your daughter is a born teacher. She should be a teacher." And they just assumed I was going to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I became.
I see.
That wasn't because it was foreordained or anything. I just enjoyed teaching.
Uh-huh. Well, you mentioned a bit earlier that your mother had been employed as well as a buyer and a model. Did she continue that employment after a marriage with your father?
No, that was completely ended. And when she had been living in Detroit, my mother was just a terribly resourceful person, and I remember she came out to the West Coast when she was about in 1910 or 11, and in those days, she and her cousin were accompanied by the cousin's mother, my mother's aunt, as a chaperone. You would not let two unmarried girls come to the West Coast all the way from Indiana and Michigan. And so they were out here for about 6 months, and they were here during the rainy season down, and they were living down in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mother had just met somebody from Bullock's Wilshire on the train when they were coming out. And they got talking, and he said, "Well, if you want a job while you're out here, come and see me." And so Mother went to work for Bullock's Wilshire while she was in Los Angeles. I later read her diary. It was not a very happy experience, because she kept counting the days until she could finish. But Mother was going with a man by the name of Baron Long, who was kind of a financier and built the U.S. Grant Hotel and had a yacht and all that sort of thing. My brother and I always kept saying to her, "Mother, how come you never married him?" But at any rate, she wanted to get some traveling out of her system, and I guess when we'd say, "How come you married Harry?" because your father was a very good man, a steady man, somebody whose word was his bond, you could count on it, a gentleman. And no question about it that a lot of the people she went with were kind of people out of the business world.
Mm-hmm.
That whose company and whatnot she enjoyed a lot. But she never, if she ever missed it, she never said anything.
Mm-hmm. So
she was so busy, I don't think she had time to worry about.
She had been accustomed, though, to some level of comfort and, and opulence, maybe even with some of the people that she was
absolutely
traveling with at one point in her life. And then after she married your father, she became essentially a homemaker and one who apparently worked very hard at providing food and looking after the household.
She did. She made everything that I wore and that my brother wore up to a point where it was hard to do things for boys. But all the clothes that I had until I went off to college practically were made by her. I guess we started buying store-bought clothes for me when I was maybe a junior or a senior in high school, because I know the clothes that I wore to dances and parties and things like that in my senior year in high school were bought and not made.
You must have had a fairly sizable garden if you were supplying all your own food. Yes. Did you live in sort of a semi-rural environment?
Well, when my mother and father built this house, it was on the edge of town. There were farmers' fields all around us. Much of that land was owned by this Mrs. Bell, my father's aunt. And we inherited, among other things, about 28 acres that were not then within the city limits, but were in wheat, and on the end of it, there was a big limestone quarry. Mm-hmm. My father and mother together developed some of those acres into a development, laid out the streets, put in the sidewalks, and planted trees, and made an addition, actually, which they called the Bell Addition,
mm-hmm.
and the Bell Hoffman Addition, I guess it was, because it was a Mr. Hoffman in the deal some way, too, and sold some of the lots, and then later on sold some of the upper end of it to the stone quarry, and then gave, I think it was 8 acres to the city of Bellevue for a park. And the city put a water stand up there that disturbed all the neighbors and bothered us too. But I guess, as I recall it, the land was given to them. They could do what they wanted to with it. Mm-hmm. So they used some of it for park. But they did put up this big water stand. Bellevue is over an underground river that goes through that limestone rock, and about 7 miles from where we live is a little town called Castalia that was named after the springs area, because in that town there's something called the Blue Hole, and this huge round body of water that has no oxygen in it, and so the growth that's inside that thing is sort of fungi and vegetation that doesn't require oxygen. It does not, it isn't green, it's kind of yellow, and thousands of gallons of water pour out of there every minute and go into creeks. And once those creeks are aerated, they're wonderful trout streams, and from Toledo there are a couple of fishing clubs that have their clubs along those streams. And they never knew whether that was part of the outlet of this underground river. They did sort of what they've done up at Black Butte, trying to figure out where does the Metolius come from. Mm-hmm. Actually, nobody really ever knew, even though they put all those colored pieces of metal and cork and all that sort of thing in it and tried to see where did it come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody, there was no sewer system in town. Everybody had a sinkhole, we called them cesspool, and a something else. and you just drilled for the sewage system. That's all changed now, of course, same as it is in Redmond. We used to do the same thing there because there were underground streams every place, and the water was very pure because it went through all of the limestone filtering. But every now and then you'd get it in reverse, and some of those springs would turn into artesian wells, and we had floods in Bellevue too. Yes. And of course, in the flood of 1913, my grandparents' home was underwater in Fort Wayne, because there the couple of rivers converge, and you may remember a couple of years ago Fort Wayne had a bad flood, and it was on TV all the time, where the St. Joe and the St. Mary's River come together. And the piano that I learned to play the piano on, which was my mother's prized possession, which she bought out of her own money, was up on some kind of sawhorses or something in the family home in Fort Wayne during the 1913 flood, and was saved, but it did have some lines on it where the water came up a little ways. But so we'd get a little bit of flooding in Bellevue, and we'd get these sinkholes that would turn into springs, and water would shoot out of them. Sort of strange geological happenings, which I never, unfortunately, knew enough about.
Let's see.
But it made life interesting. We also had tornadoes that went through there that would, you know, those awful twisters. And my father used to say to us, this is my brother and me, when you see that color sky in the west, and almost all those storms came from the west, and our house faced south, but our porch was a west to east exposure. He said, you come home, because if we're going to die, we're all going to die together. And we would all go down in the cellar. Everybody had a cellar. Used that for lots of things, including storing vegetables and eggs in water glass and all that sort of thing. And we would stand against the west wall. The house right next to ours was brick. We always figured the brick house wouldn't blow over. And if it did, we wouldn't get it if we were on this west wall. Mm-hmm. But my grandfather Hill came to live with us after my grandmother died. I was only about 6 or 7 years old when Grandma Hill died. And so he lived with us from the time I was about 8 years old, I guess. He had this wooden leg where his leg had been amputated. And he was a very stubborn Englishman. I remember us getting along very well. My mother always said she couldn't have lived with her mother-in-law living in the house, but her father-in-law and she got along just fine. But he loved to watch those storms. And I can remember one time at least when he was out on the porch, wind is blowing like crazy, trees are being twisted off, grandfather can't get his wooden leg on the floor. My brother had to go out there on his hands and knees and hold on to grandfather's foot and plant it so he could take another step so we could get grandfather in the house. But we used to have awful hailstorms with ice as big as eggs, you know, blowing through windows and all that sort of thing. They were rather scary, horrendous storms. But mother always taught us that you had to live with them, you do certain things that make sense, and you don't panic. That's the main thing, don't panic. Mm-hmm. So I can recall times when those hailstorms were coming through leaded windows that were in our dining room, that we were holding parts of erector sets, log cabins. We had some of those Lincoln logs, holding the platforms up against the window with the green stain running down our arms, keeping hailstones from coming in the house.
Is that family home still standing in Bellevue?
Yes. We added 4 rooms on the end of it when my grandfather came to live with us, because my mother was a great believer that everyone should have a bedroom of his own or her own. And so we only had a 3-bedroom house. And my brother and I were growing up, we had occupied 2 brass beds in the same bedroom until we got a little bit older. And so when grandfather came too, that was another reason to do it. So we added 2 bedrooms in, enlarged the kitchen, and built a sunroom on these big old square houses, you know, just had a bigger square roof. Mm-hmm. And so that's the house where my bachelor brother still lives.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you mentioned that earlier. Okay, fine.
And we acquired the lot next door to it, which my mother used for a garden, and mother did all her own gardening too, and her her flower garden really was kind of a show place. And they did it all, those ladies did, without spending a lot of money, but they knew every new hybrid iris that came out, mostly the ones grown in Silverton, Oregon. I can remember that all the iris originally came from there, and peonies and roses and all that sort of thing. But what they did was that someone would decide to buy it, the iris, when it was expensive and new and a hybrid and be a show piece kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then they divided. And Mother always called her garden her friendship garden, because she could tell you the history of almost every plant that was there. She was a terrific gardener, and you didn't call a rose, you had to know what its name was. And many is the hour I traipsed around gardens with her while these ladies were dickering about what was going to go where and when it was the right time to transplant. You would do that, and I'd carry the boxes and that sort of thing. I'm afraid not too much of the gardening rubbed off on me, although Mother did do her best after Sam and I moved to Redmond, but she was frustrated by the weather conditions in Redmond that didn't fit.
Yeah.
Either.
Yeah. Did you and your brother have chores around the house and outside the house?
You bet. Every Saturday we had to clean the upstairs, and we always helped with the kitchen work. But the upstairs, it was divided. So many rooms in the hallway for him, and so many rooms in the bathroom for me, and we switched bathroom and hallway from time to time. And if we lagged behind, Mother was, all our lives, she was one of the greatest disciplinarians in the world, but what she used was a stick which she would cut off a cherry tree. Sour cherry tree grew right by our back door, and they had these limber switches. She would go out there, and just like that, she could have the leaves off that switch. And she would come up and say, if you fellas don't settle down, you want a taste of what you're going to get. And, you know, just a few flicks around the leg with those switches. And it didn't hurt her that much, but boy, it stung us. And so if we ran away, if we were going to get switched, we just got it twice as bad when she caught us. And she wouldn't chase us or anything. It was just a matter, you better step up and take your punishment. Mm-hmm. My father spanked me only once, and I know it hurt him more than it hurt me, but it was something I never forgot. My father, I guess as many fathers are, terrible pushovers for daughters. I was the first grandchild in the family and was a daughter, and he would just terribly devoted to me. He didn't hesitate to spank my brother, but I got it just once. But Mother passed it out, you know, indiscriminately. It didn't make any difference whether it was Bob or whether it was I. We got it. I must say, I think we deserved it. Most of the time, I never felt that either one of them was unnecessarily strict. I do remember when I was in high school, I had gone to some kind of a high school function, and I had stayed out later than we were supposed to. And when I walked in the house, I heard my father say to my mother, they were sitting in the kitchen. That was a favorite gathering place at our house. You suppose she's going to turn into one of those smart alecky high school kids? And I didn't even ever hear the answer, but I never forgot his saying that. And in those days, it was lots easier to grow up, a lot easier than it is now, because you knew what was right, you knew what was wrong, you knew what was expected. You did a lot of the doubting in things like a young people's group that would gather at the Methodist church at 6 o'clock on a Sunday night, and we'd thresh out a lot of things and talked about utopia and what might be the idealism and questioning the Bible, questioning God, questioning all these things, but under the leadership of somebody. And then very often after those young people's meetings, we'd all shift to our house, where my mother always would produce food for that whole gang of kids, and where they didn't mind if we danced on the rugs. And we had a radio, and we used to listen to the Sax Rohmer mystery stories. Everybody went home by about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and there wasn't a lot of holding hands and overt expressions, you know, of of affection between young people, even though you knew that so-and-so was really smitten with somebody. There would be dating, but there wasn't going steady in a lot of the problems. I sound as if I'm idealizing it. It really wasn't all that ideal, but it's just the way things were. And if everybody was doing it, by that I mean, we would gather to study around our dining room table. Lots of times we were there. It was during Prohibition. My father made homebrew. So did the father and grandfather of one of my friends where we gathered also. And they would offer us a glass of beer, but it would be one of those little, like, Kraft cheese glasses, little tiny thing of home brew. It was never a matter of anybody's getting drunk, but it was Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't live in a place like Sam did in Berkeley, where there were speakeasies and where if you had money you could get liquor, and where there was liquor imported from someplace in the family. My father made wine all the time. He made it out of everything you could think of. And I remember one time when my grandfather died of cancer at our house, and I can't remember exactly what year that was, how old I was, but about like 14, I think. And my mother and father were out. There was cherry wine in the basement, and you know, you'd have bungs and rubber hoses that went into a glass of water while the wine was working in the keg. And that there were some workmen there at the house, and they'd gotten into it, apparently stuck the thing on, and in such a way that it wasn't working, and it blew up, and all this wine was blowing over the basement. And I hopped on my bicycle and ran down to the home of some people we called aunt and uncle. They weren't any relation to us, but Uncle Jake and my dad looked a lot alike, and got him to come up to the house, and he and I hosed down that basement because I was sure that the feds would smell it. There were a lot of these Italians that did make wine all the time, stuff they called Dago Red, and they sold it. They were being arrested all the time for making wine. But that's all I remember much of Prohibition. The young people were not drinking. We did not have booze in cars when we went out. Now, I know our contemporaries in cities did have, or if you had enough money to get it.
You described your mother as a strong Lutheran. Did that have an impact on your own religious upbringing?
I was brought up as a Lutheran. Mm-hmm. This was the American Lutheran Church in Bellevue. My father was a 32nd degree Mason. My mother had been brought up in the Missouri Synod in Fort Wayne. And the Missouri Synod was very, very strict about secret societies. And mother was ostracized or excommunicated or whatever you want to call it from her church when she married my father. Because of the you couldn't be a Missouri Synod. And in Fort Wayne, a lot of the Masons, you could be an Elk, but you couldn't be a Mason. Those families got together and built a beautiful church in Fort Wayne, a Lutheran church, where the people who couldn't belong to the Missouris went to church. Fort Wayne was largely German, almost the whole town. There were more people whose names ended in Meyer than you could shake a fist at. So they were mostly Catholics or Lutherans.
Mm-hmm.
And they fraternized, because the Missouri Synod Lutherans and the Catholics were not that far apart.
Yes.
So when Mother and Dad moved to Bellevue, that Lutheran church was a different synod. And so there was no problem about my dad. My dad had been brought up as a Congregationalist by his English forebears. His family was just as much English as my mother's family. We're all German.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a strange situation. I don't mean strange. I mean it's a... what an alliance that some people would say not so good.
Yeah.
And English and German. But he became a Lutheran. He was baptized the same day I was in the Lutheran church. And the only thing that he said to the minister, I have no reservations at all about joining the Lutheran Church, except one thing. You have to tell me whether you think that little innocent baby, if she were to die tomorrow, is going to go to hell because of the original sin. I cannot believe that, and I won't believe it. And whoever the minister was at that time was very judicious in his answer, at least whatever he told my father satisfied him.